Sure. It's 9:06. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. We will probably never know the why behind the mass shootings in Newtown, Connecticut last month, but many of the conversations since have focused on two items, guns and mental illness. President Obama made the connection right after the tragedy, saying we are going to need to work on making access to mental health care as easy as access to a gun. But mental health professionals say you can only take that connection so far. For example, a federal study of the 120,000 gun-related murders over the past decade found that few were committed by people with mental health issues. Still, here in the Granite State, there is deep and growing concern about the rising lack of access to mental health treatment and the impact on families, public safety, hospital emergency rooms. Ken Norton of the New Hampshire chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness spoke at a news conference on Tuesday.
The current practice of holding people in a mental health crisis in an emergency department for days at a time, waiting for a bed at New Hampshire Hospital, is wrong medically, legally, economically, ethically, and morally.
Norton was part of an event organized by a coalition of community mental health groups, hospital leaders, parents of children with mental illness, and police officers, all of whom related tales of a broken system and their fears about the future. Today in The Exchange, mental health again in the spotlight, the first of a three-day look at some of the possible lessons and conversations surrounding the Newtown attack. Let's get your thoughts. What do you think? Should we be making this connection between violent outbursts like Newtown and mental illness or not? And here in New Hampshire, what have you seen in terms of the mental health system's ability to respond to a crisis? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We have three guests in studio. With us is Ken Norton, who we just heard from, Executive Director for the New Hampshire Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Ken Norton, thank you for coming in. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
Also with us, Nancy Rollins, Associate Commissioner at New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services, who oversees many aspects of DHHS, including mental health. And Nancy, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Dr. Robert Murray, psychiatrist, vice president, and medical director of Riverbend Community Mental Health in Concord. And Dr. Murray, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Well, to all of you, but Dr. Murray first, just what do you think of people, including the president, making this connection between Newtown or Aurora, Colorado, or Virginia Tech, or any of these other massacres? What do you think of people making the connection between these and mental illness? How do you feel about that, Dr. Murray?
Well, it's not surprising. However, it is, in my view, always unfortunate because there is little or no evidence to actually associate a high risk of violence with mental illness. Yet we see it all the time in the media. We hear it in popular conversation. We know that that connection exists in the mind of the public. It's actually interesting. A survey was done to look at Americans' attitude toward violence and mental illness. And in fact, Americans were more likely to associate violence and mental illness in the 1990s than they were when they were surveyed in the 1950s.
Even though attitudes about mental illness in the 1950s were probably not as well informed as
exactly.
They are
and
today.
It's a sad comment because that connection, I think, fuels a lot of the stigma that people with mental illness struggle with in their day-to-day lives.
So you use the word unfortunate, Dr. Murray. How come? I mean, I think I know where you're going, but unfortunate, why?
The consequence is that I think it leads individuals who have mental illness to feel a sense of shame, a sense of discomfort. It's an impediment to people seeking a diagnosis and treatment because of that connection. It fuels what we refer to as a general stigma associated with the mentally ill.
What do you think, Nancy Rollins? You've been in this field a long time. What do you think of people making this connection again?
Well, I concur with Dr. Murray relative to, you know, research does demonstrate that the greatest percent of individuals who have mental illness do not pose a threat nor have engaged in violent behavior. But then I think there's the natural reaction to something that is so horrific, so tragic in our society that not to get into, you know, specific diagnosis or vernacular or whatever, but the response is like, you got to be crazy to have done this.
Mm-hmm.
Why else would anyone do this? So I understand that response, But I concur with Dr. Murray that I think it doesn't help with issues that we have been struggling with for some period of time relative to stigma and working with consumers and so forth.
It's part of the human condition, though, isn't it, Nancy? You know, the search for why. We try to
Absolutely.
Find some sort of meaning out of something that just seems, as you said, crazy.
Why, with the hope that we can prevent. And that's a real challenge.
So here's something that I saw on USA Today, Ken Norton, and I'll turn to you. Both Nancy and Dr. Murray have said it's unfortunate that this connection is being made. But here's something from USA Today. Virginia Tech, the shooter there who killed 32 people, had a long history of mental illness. In Tucson, Jared Lochner, who is serving a sentence for killing 6 and wounding 19 others, diagnosed with schizophrenia. And then in Aurora, the case that's on trial now, the movie theater shooting, James Holmes, described by mentally ill by his defense attorney. So here we have these shooters who do seem to have some mental health issues. What do you think?
Well, we can't deny that connection is there. And I think echoing what's already been said, this is a very, very small minority of the population that have mental illness. And that certainly means that we need to discuss it and we need to talk about what is available. But as Dr. Murray said, one of the bigger challenges is how this impacts on people seeking help. And one of the things that we know is that up to 50% of people with serious mental illness never seek treatment. And that includes our veterans as well. And our veterans that are coming back and self-identifying as having psychological injuries.
So 50% of people who need some sort of mental health treatment never seek it.
Correct.
And we'll never know, again, the motivations behind the person who conducted the Newtown shootings. But I do wonder how you feel, Ken, again, as someone who's worked in this field for a long time, about people all the way up to the president saying, yeah, there's a connection there.
Well, I think it's part of the conversation that we need to be having. And, I think part of that conversation is around issues of access to mental health treatment. And as the president said, and I think we could all agree, that it should be as easy to get a mental health appointment as it is to purchase a gun.
And later on this week, we're going to be looking more directly at the gun issue. Tomorrow, we'll look at violence in video games. Friday, the gun issue. So today, we're looking at mental health and whether there is a connection between mental illness and some of the violent outbursts that we've seen recently, including, of course, the most recent mass shooting in Newtown. We'd love to hear from you this hour. What do you think of people making this connection? Is it off base or on target? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. We also want your own experiences as a loved one of someone with mental illness or someone with some mental health issues yourself. What are your experiences with the mental health system here in New Hampshire? Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And before we go to our listeners, Dr. Murray, so all of you have said the connection is small, but we should talk about it. What are those instances, Dr. Murray, where someone in the throes of a mental health crisis might pose a danger to themselves or others? What types of mental illness are you especially looking for with a connection to violence?
Well, when we talk about violence toward others, if the illness involves untreated symptoms that include mistaken or delusional beliefs, is the technical term for that, that could lead people to feel as if others are threatening them, there can sometimes be a self-protective response, which is understandable in the context of the mistaken belief. If you believe that someone else means you harm or that someone else might attack you, you may be inclined to defend yourself, to anticipate that attack.
You see a threat that isn't there.
You see a threat that isn't there, and you respond to that threat. It's one of the instances in which it is very important to be able to identify that a person is suffering from that type of symptom and to intervene quickly and positively to make a difference, to ensure their safety and the safety of others. I think it is one of the instances that really highlights some of the things you were talking about before around access to care. It is critical when a person is feeling that way or their family, loved ones, friends see them in that condition to be able to take definitive action and have access to treatment. And unfortunately, as things exist in the nation as a whole and in our state as well, there are often delays, roadblocks, and barriers to that treatment.
Are there particular mental illnesses then that you're looking at, Dr. Murray? For example, I mentioned schizophrenia earlier. Are there certain diagnoses that might lead one to more violent behavior?
There are a number of diagnoses in which that can be an issue. What I was speaking about before is the type of thing that you can see in a schizophrenic illness. You can see in a very severe manic episode with delusional beliefs and impulsivity when people act very quickly, very impulsively. But you can also see violence and risk of violence in conditions that are diagnosable as illnesses in the diagnostic manual, but are involved things that really are more rooted in people's personalities, worldview, ability to relate to others. These are things apart from what we think of as some of the major mental illnesses like mood disorders, depression, mania, bipolar illness, schizophrenia.
Wow. And Ken, just quickly to you, it's worth pointing out, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I'm right. When we talk about violence and mental illness, often the person most at risk is the person with mental illness, right?
Correct. They're much more likely to be victims than perpetrators of crime.
Give us a little bit more on that. Yeah.
Well, I think that people with mental illness in its severe form can be very vulnerable. We know that there's high rates of homelessness.
Suicide.
Suicide, second leading cause of death in our state, ages 10 to 34. And it's notable that that two of the three shooters that you mentioned obviously took their own lives or presumably took their own lives. And that, for young men, that's, a very serious issue. 80% of the suicide deaths in the U.S. are men. Ages 35 to 54, it's the fourth leading cause of death. But I think the other thing that is important to enter into this conversation is that, there are bad people that don't have mental illness.
Yeah, and that's been talked about a lot, too. And we'll pick up on that thread after a short break. Lots and lots of listeners, too, who want to join in. So you can be part of our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And more on the spotlight on mental illness coming up on The Exchange. And then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, President Obama's choices for key positions for his second term. NHPR welcomes TED Radio Hour to our weekly lineup. The popular TED Talks features lectures from some of the world's most innovative thinkers and doers. Be listening Saturday afternoons at 1 o'clock. You can find details of this and other new programs at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Jaguar Exeter, introducing instinctive all-wheel drive on 2013 Jaguar XJ and XF models. Enhance traction while retaining the authentic Jaguar driving experience, jaguarexeter.com. And from Southern New Hampshire Montessori Academy, bringing educational choice for elementary students, individualized experiential learning in a multi-age setting. Details at snhma.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, in light of the Newtown attack, an evaluation of New Hampshire's mental health system, we're looking at whether we should be making a connection between violent outbursts and mental illness. Also here in New Hampshire, we're looking at the status of the mental health system in light of a news conference held earlier this week talking about its many weaknesses. Our number here in The Exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. By the way, today's program is the first in a three-part look at the conversation post-Newtown. Again, today we're looking at mental illness, tomorrow video game violence, and on Friday we'll look more closely at the gun issue. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us now. And Dr. Robert Murray, Ken Norton, Nancy Rollins, lots of people who want to join us, but Nancy, to you first, real quickly, I have read that more often there's a connection between alcohol and drug abuse that fuels violent behavior more than any mental illness does. How do you see that?
Absolutely. I would concur with that. Certainly for persons who have no mental illness, We know that alcohol or substance abuse can cause behaviors to escalate to the point of violence. But certainly in circumstances, regardless almost of diagnosis, again, it can exacerbate the circumstance. It can flatten the affect and the even sense of what they're engaged in and the horrific acts that they're engaged in.
Yeah, people get drunk or high, and then a day later they say, oh, my gosh.
Absolutely.
What have I done? And real quickly to you, Ken, you mentioned earlier that 50% of people with mental illness don't seek treatment. Is it possible that some people who are acting violently under the influence of drugs and alcohol also have mental illness? They're self-medicating with drugs and alcohol, so their mental illness is undiagnosed.
Absolutely. There's very high co-occurrence of mental illness and substance use disorders, and certainly I think more of the folks that we're seeing being admitted to our state psychiatric facility have those co-occurring disorders. And those are the more challenging cases, and people are self-medicating or they're dealing with addiction issues, and they are more likely to be to die by suicide, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So those co-occurring cases are very difficult.
Challenging because you don't really know what's the major actor here. Is it the drugs? Is it the mental illness? You know, what is it? It's harder to untangle it.
Well, it's both.
Yeah. All right. Lots of people who want to join our conversation. So again, I invite you with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the exchange page at nhpr.org. And let's go to Dan in Portsmouth first. Hi, Dan. Thanks for waiting. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of put an example out there that I'm the father of a teenager with diagnosed mental illness. And we've had several instances where he's been in crisis and needed to be hospitalized. And the advice from his New Hampshire-based outpatient clinicians have been to take him to emergency rooms in Massachusetts.
Really?
Because, yes. And he's been hospitalized 3 times in Massachusetts. We were told to do that simply because the facilities there are more numerous and better. You know, that's quite shocking to us. And I would say my other point is that it seems that at every tier of the mental health system, not just in New Hampshire, but even in Massachusetts, the people are being treated there, but really could use an even more intensive level of treatment than they're getting. So our son's intermittent hospitalizations, really what he could use is sort of longer-term residential treatment, but you have to be even sicker to get that. So I just throw that out there, that you know, we've been faced with this real paucity in one of the richest parts of New Hampshire, of the treatment. You know, we've got insurance. We can pay for this. It's just that the facilities aren't even there.
Wow. And Dan, I'm so sorry to hear. What a struggle for you.
It is. But you know, we're fortunate to have what we've got, and thank you for that. But I just wanted to put that in the conversation.
Yeah, lots to talk about. Dan, thanks a lot for calling in. And boy, a couple points to follow up on. First of all, I think to you again, Ken Norton, send your child to ERs in Massachusetts. They've got better facilities.
Well, it's a very sobering comment. And, you know, I have heard recently that this is occurring more often in our state. And certainly one of the challenges that we faced in talking about this access issue at the big press conference on Monday is that, you know, while we're talking about the realities of people waiting to get inpatient beds in our state, then does that inadvertently give the message to people that they shouldn't come forward when they need help?
You know, and he even has insurance. And Nancy, I do wonder, you know, there's so much emphasis when we talk about availability of treatment on the state and its funding or lack thereof of the community mental health system. But Dan saying, hey, we've got good insurance and we still have a hard time. I'm struck by that.
Well, one of the things with private insurance is while there has been attempts in Congress and here in this state as well relative to achieving parity for substance abuse and mental health treatment, it really does not necessarily purchase the types of services that people with mental illness need to have in the community, such as intensive supports, assertive community treatment teams, in-home supports that can assist both the families as well as the youngster and make sure that They're helping to train people to deal with and manage not only the mental illness, but perhaps challenging behaviors, whether that's at school or wherever else. So most private insurances are still very traditional in outpatient treatment, which has a place. But in many instances, people with serious mental illness or a serious emotional disturbance need far more intensive supports in the community. And then along the full continuum, we have 24 beds for children and adolescents at New Hampshire Hospital.
Not very much for
not
a state of 1.3 million.
Correct. And as private hospitals or some of the few other public hospitals have continued to decrease the inpatient beds, that has been largely for adults. There's always been sort of a paucity of inpatient beds and services for adolescents or children. In addition to that, you know, we need to continue to look at what are the community-based supports that are needed to keep kids from even having to be institutionalized. Community-based alternatives to hospitalization, crisis beds, short-term, and so forth.
You know, it is interesting on the private insurance. So you're saying, pick up on what you said, Nancy, private insurance is still based on kind of an old-fashioned model of what people need.
Particularly for people with serious mental illness, yes. I would say so. It pays for a certain amount of time inpatient, and it pays for a certain amount of limited sessions outpatient.
Does it pay for medication?
Oh, it will pay for medication. There's no question about that. But it's the difference between seeing a therapist one-on-one for maybe a 50-minute hour versus having a direct support person who is assisting that youngster deal with their issues in the community and also working with the family and so forth using case management or care coordination.
Well, Dan, good luck to you. Thank you for joining us. And let's take another one. This is Nicole in Nashua. Hi, Nicole. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead. All right. Maybe Nicole will call back. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And to Ken in Concord. Hi, Ken. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have spent time in emergency rooms waiting for psych beds. It was more than 5 years ago, and the most time I ever spent was 12 hours. And I can easily believe that it's much, much worse now. But my experience was bad enough. Being in an emergency room waiting for a psych bed is a nightmare. First of all, you're traumatized when you come in, and you are continually re-traumatized in the emergency room. The emergency room people are not very nice to psych patients. You're put in a room by yourself, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait. First for an evaluation from the mental health center. It's usually late at night, so that takes a long time to get. And you wait, and you wait, and you wait. And while you're waiting, you're getting more and more traumatized and going more and more crazy, forgive the language. The other thing I wanted to mention is that when you go for emergency help, you can usually get it, but you give up control of what kind of help you get.
I see.
It's much better if you can avoid the emergency room, and we have several ways to do that.
Well, and let's talk about that, avoiding the emergency room, for sure. And when Dan was talking, too, I thought, gosh, it's too bad it even gets to that point. But to his first point first, and Ken, thank you so much for calling in. Dr. Murray, the status of emergency rooms and what happens to people in emergency rooms was a big focus of this news conference on Monday. What happens when people are waiting in the ER for a bed for some help?
Well, I think Ken did a very good job of describing what happens. You wait and wait and wait. What emergency rooms lack are the kinds of therapeutic services, supportive services that are available on a good inpatient unit. There are activities, groups, therapies going on. But in the emergency room, you have an assessment, a determination is made that you need to be hospitalized. But if there is no bed available, there it is mostly waiting, marking time.
And as he said, it made his crisis worse.
Absolutely. I can very much understand that. And we see this happening with people becoming more anxious, more troubled as they sit and wait and nothing happens. And Ken talked about what it was like for him to spend maybe up to 12 hours in the emergency room. People are spending as much as 4, 5, 6 days in the emergency room.
And who's taking care of them while they're there, making sure that they don't have a complete breakdown, hurt themselves, hurt somebody else?
It varies throughout the state. It would be, you know, in some places, entirely the care is delivered by the staff in the emergency department who take care of all of the injuries and illnesses that come through the door. The larger hospitals and those that have a connection with a mental health center may have some specialized staffing, some nurses with some training in mental health, but that is the exception, not the rule.
Can you comment on this too, Ken Norton? I know this is a big topic for you at the news conference earlier this week.
Sure. I would just add to what Dr. Murray said, that it's also families that are often spending days. I mean, we had an email from a family member who she and her husband had spent 4 days, day and night, took time off from their jobs to be with their son who was waiting in the emergency room. And I also think Ken's points were very well taken. There's not much more to elucidate other than to say that physically, emergency departments are inherently dangerous places for people that may have high degrees of impulsivity or poor judgment or maybe hallucinating. And so certainly that's a consideration as well.
Okay, so this situation is dangerous for the other folks in the ER, to the person in the throes of a mental health crisis, him or herself. Bad for the hospital, obviously, not good for the staff, and so forth. So who do you point to, Ken, when you say, look, enough is enough? I mean, who do you say, step up and fix this?
Well, I really think that we have to look to our legislative leaders and our elected officials to be the ones to make the next steps and to provide funding that's adequate to get the system back on its feet again.
Community mental health centers.
Oh, it's not just community mental health centers. It's broader than that. But yes, community, you know, that's a big part of the equation. But I think as our first caller, Dan, had indicated, there's also a lack of private or local hospital beds for, you know, for perhaps voluntary admissions. I mean, the whole system has deteriorated.
So who should pay for those beds? Should that be part of the hospital's expense? Should private insurance cover that? Is that a state responsibility?
Well, I think as Nancy indicated, there are challenges with insurance, even for people that have insurance, and discriminating laws, what has been in the past, although the Affordable Care Act has attempted to address that would put lifetime caps and other limits on, you know, people seeking inpatient mental health treatment or any mental health treatment.
And Nancy, got to get you in on this again. You're with Department of Health and Human Services, which, you know, has been criticized for not doing enough. I think there's a plan for 12 more beds at New Hampshire Hospital. People have said that's not enough still. Your thoughts here? And by the way, I want to let everybody know we tried to get some state lawmakers on to join us on the financial side, and they were unable to or didn't want to join us. Go ahead, Nancy.
Sure. Thanks, Laura. Certainly, you know, we concur that we are at a point here that is extremely critical, and the commissioner released prior to the holidays, and we recognize this is just a very short-term, intermediate action plan where we are proceeding with looking to reopen a unit at New Hampshire Hospital that would put 12 more beds online. Keep in mind that with the difficult budget sessions we've had in the last few years, from 2008 to 2012, we lost 60 beds at New Hampshire Hospital.
60?
60. At the same time, we were losing community resources. So the circumstances have exacerbated. I also have to point out, however, that while we're moving towards this, things don't move quickly in state government. We have to rehab some of that unit because the type of individuals who were there previously had different kinds of needs. So we need to retrofit it. And we also need to reclassify some state positions in order to do – I mean, it's the machinations of state government. But even privately, if you were to do this, it's not like you can snap your fingers and something comes on a line immediately because you've got to hire people. The other thing is that we need to continue to look at, and I forgot who had mentioned it, other community resources like crisis beds. We have 8 peer support programs throughout the state that equates to 14 locations. One of them has a crisis respite bed that they manage, and we're looking to expand that. We're looking to train other peer support programs to be able to do that. In addition, we have an acute psychiatric treatment facility in Manchester that's not hospital-based, that has 16 beds. It's the Cypress Center with Manchester Mental Health runs. We'd like to see several others of those come online.
And that's a better place for folks to go than the ER at Concord Hospital or
absolutely,
wherever.
And particularly because it's in their own community. Frequently, people are coming from the greater Manchester area. The other thing I want to point about ERs is that because of the lack of psychiatric beds within their hospital systems, the people with psychiatric issues sitting in the ER are not waiting for a bed in that facility. They're waiting for a bed at New Hampshire Hospital. You know,
and there aren't enough beds there.
Correct.
So they wait and wait and wait.
Correct.
Like our caller
well,
said.
But again, it's not just New Hampshire Hospital. If we had other community resources, we would be able to manage.
Well, thanks for that call, Ken. Lots to talk about. And let's go next to Sheila, also in Concord. Hi, Sheila. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I am an attorney who regularly represents individuals who are faced with a petition for involuntary commitment to New Hampshire Hospital. And I wanted to get back to the issue of treatment for individuals who are mentally ill and who are also alleged to be dangerous. What I wanted to bring to the discussion is that as an attorney who represents individuals, my observation over the past 8 years is that family members and psychiatrists and community mental health providers are pretty vigilant in filing these petitions when they think that an individual is not only mentally ill but also a danger to self or others, which is the standard for admission to New Hampshire Hospital on an involuntary basis. And sometimes, as an attorney, I think that the allegations are rather thin. But what happens is that those allegations and the individual are examined by an independent psychiatrist. They go before a judge, and my observation is that the judicial system is and the psychiatrist, you know, certainly are going to err on the side of safety if the evidence shows that. So I did want to point that out. Plus, you know, psychiatrists, nobody can identify somebody who is going to be violent if they haven't been violent already. It's just impossible. And of course, the other issue is that, as has been said, many individuals who are mentally ill are never violent. It has nothing to do with mental illness.
Sheila, thank you so much for calling. We'll pick up on that point after a short break. So thanks for being part of our conversation today. You can join us too at 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and Cedar Crest Center for Children with Disabilities, enriching the lives of children with complex medical and developmental needs and supporting their families, cedarcrestcenter.org. And from Comcast Business Class, provider of Internet voice, TV, and Ethernet solutions that keep pace with the growth of your business. More information at business.comcast.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR is making it easier for you to keep up with what's going on in New Hampshire politics. I'm Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. Join me on the political front Monday mornings. I'll preview scheduled business and pending legislation at the State House and take a broader look at New Hampshire's political landscape. I'll be checking in with Rick Ganley every Monday at 7:30 during Morning Edition on NHPR. And you can follow me on Twitter throughout the week at Josh Rogers, NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the second in our three-part look at the conversation post-Newtown. Tomorrow, we'll look at the debate over video game violence, and then on Friday, we'll look at the gun issue. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the mental health system once again, a system many describe nationally and here in New Hampshire as broken. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Ken Norton, Nancy Rollins, Dr. Robert Murray, just before the break, we heard from Sheila. And Dr. Murray, real quick to you. Sheila talked about her clients, she's a lawyer, who are involuntarily committed to New Hampshire Hospital. They don't want to go there, but their family says, no, you're a threat to yourself or to society and you need to go.
And it is true that almost every patient admitted to New Hampshire Hospital is admitted involuntarily. So that's something that we know in our work in the field, but the public may not be aware of. New Hampshire Hospital is primarily an involuntary facility. There are only a handful of patients there who were there voluntarily for very particular reasons. So it is the facility. It is the go-to place for individuals who are being, as it were, forced into treatment.
Well, that must be really hard, though. I mean, if someone doesn't want to go, but their loved one says, no, I feel like you're a threat to yourself or a threat to others, that must be really hard. How do you figure that out?
Well, it's a very difficult issue. I mean, society has been struggling with this for the past 200 years.
And has made some really bad mistakes, as we've heard. You know,
absolutely.
Way back when husbands used to put their wives away at New Hampshire Hospital just because they were getting on their nerves.
Yeah. I mean, quick history, up until the 1970s, in most states, you could be put away for the rest of your life on the signature of two physicians with no review.
So how is it now? How well
it's
do you
quite
strike,
different.
Quite
do different.
Strike a balance
At this
now?
Point, the balance is struck that involuntary treatment really is only an option in situations where there is clear and present evidence of dangerousness to self or others. Either that person will suicide or perhaps assault another person. There's been some clear indication that they are thinking of doing that or have made an attempt to do that, and it can be shown that this is so. And then there's, as Sheila in her call pointed out, there's due process for that. The individual who is involuntarily committed has access to counsel who can bring out other points, a different point of view. And it's all heard before a judicial person.
I wonder, given all the attention and all the worry about mass shootings just in recent years, if the balance is going to shift more towards commitment now, that no judge is going to want to be the person who let the next shooter go.
Well, I think that I have greater faith in our judiciary. I think that they do have a sense of what the law is. They, in every action, have to parse out individual rights versus society versus the law and make a decision that's informed by precedent and jurisprudence. So I think that the idea that our judges may be carried away by sentiment and run roughshod over people's rights, I think, is probably not founded.
Nancy, can I get some quick thoughts from you here, and then I really want to go back to our listeners.
The only other point is that in addition to New Hampshire Hospital, and it is a delicate balance that goes on in the judicial system relative to due process and IEAs and so forth, but we also have the
What's
state
an IEA?
That's the involuntary admission. I'm sorry. We also have the secure psychiatric facility at the Department of Corrections. And quite frankly, some of it is balanced between individuals who are incarcerated there versus coming back through New Hampshire Hospital. And that gets into the whole sort of not guilty by reason of insanity and so forth. But it is a very, very detailed judicial process.
All right. Let's take some more calls. Pamela's been waiting in Dover. Hi, Pamela. Thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks for taking my call and
sure.
Thanks for your show. For either of your guests, my question and comment has to do with schools and early intervention. As a special ed teacher, I've noticed that because of huge budget cuts in schools, when students need to be placed in a special school that will help meet their needs, very often they are not able to attend those schools. I've also noticed that when they leave high school, that there is no follow-up. And I'm wondering if we can create coalitions that involve schools and other mental health institutions like Health and Human Services, that we can follow those kids out into the community and so that they're not so isolated and their families are not so isolated.
Yeah, Pamela, great point. And good to hear from you given your experience in the schools. Ken Norton, your thoughts?
A great question. And there is a major initiative underway in the state for the past several years that was started by the Endowment for Health and the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation to and now being led by the Department of Health and Human Services. And the state last year received a one-year planning grant from the feds to help plan a system of care for children. And that system of care is exactly what Pamela was referring to, where it would bring in educators and residential programs and to really try, mental health centers really try to look at what the community alternatives were to make sure that systems are in place for families and youth so that all the systems are working in concert together to support the family and the children rather than sort of, you know, in isolation from each other. And particularly for transition age youth, which are those youth that are leaving the children's mental health system and going into the adult mental health system.
Yeah, and often that's an area where problems tend to crop up. Thank you, Pamela, for that point. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Also, you can post a comment on our Facebook page. Here's an email that just came in from Christopher in Manchester, who says, in all the whys about these mass shooting, the media continually ask why it's usually young men, typically in their early 20s. He asks, isn't this the age when schizophrenia usually appears and symptoms worsen? Christopher, great question. Dr. Murray, what do you think?
Definitely, schizophrenia tends to have an onset in the early 20s. That's a peak time for beginning to show signs of that illness. I think it's important, though, to realize that being young and male is highly associated with violence, even in individuals who have no mental illness whatsoever. So the idea that this might imply that a lot of the young males involved in violence might be schizophrenic or in the throes of coming down with that illness is not borne out by the statistics. But I think there are a number of other social factors, environmental factors, cultural factors that stack the risk of violence in that young male group. And it's no doubt beyond the program today, but there is a great deal more in our society that sets up atmosphere that fosters violence way beyond mental illness. It's
yeah.
a very small factor.
And we're going to tackle some of that tomorrow and on Friday. Although, Christopher, you know, the point is well taken. Again, when you look at some of these people who have committed these dreadful mass shootings, I'm looking at the list right now, you know, they're all in their early 20s.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks for the email, Christopher. And let's go back to our callers. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Claire's waiting in Londonderry, Vermont. Hi, Claire. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. First, a comment. I think the only good thing coming out of all of this is we need a national focus on full funding of mental health services. And everybody on your call is an advocate for this, and we need to push for it. We need to push for parity. To follow up on what Ken Norton said about families and people in the emergency room, emergency room staff needs to be more trained in how to deal with people with mental illness. And also there could be a program for peers to sit with people who are experiencing mental illness to help them get through 2, 3, 4, 5 days in the emergency room. I volunteer for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and I suggest everybody Google us. We do educate everybody we can meet, and if we can get rid of stigma, you will find that in the communities, people will be looking for early intervention in picking up on symptoms before things happen, but we need to look at parity. Now, my question is, how can we advocate for more services and on a national stage so we can get the money we need to deliver the services we need?
Well, and Claire, I guess you're talking not just about government funding then, which gets into the issue of who pays and taxes and so forth, but also you mentioned parity, right, which has to do with private insurance and what
right.
they cover and what they
right.
don't cover. Yeah. Boy, a big call from Claire, all of you, and maybe a good way to close out our conversation. Full funding of mental health services, does anybody have any idea of how much that would cost?
Well, I think one of the points that was made at the press conference the other day was we wouldn't even ask that question if it was cancer or heart disease, what it would cost. We would just do it. And, you know, and I guess the question, the rhetorical question in stepping back is, why haven't we done that? Why do we keep thinking that mental illness is different? And that, I mean, we know it's a biological illness like any other illness, severe mental illness. Why do we keep treating it as something other than that?
And why do you think we do?
Well, I think it's a lot about what was said at the beginning by Dr. Murray, that, you know, historically we've looked at it as personal failing or weakness or character flaws somehow. And I think we haven't really caught up. Our attitudes haven't necessarily caught up with what the research has shown us in the last 30 or 40 years.
Nancy, how much would it cost? I mean, if you had your way, there you are at Department of Health and Human Services, overseeing many items, including mental health. How much would it cost to provide that full funding that our caller talks about?
Yeah, I think it's hard to put an exact dollar amount to it. I think what we've done with the 10-year plan, just in laying out the types of services that would be needed in the community, some of the things I've talked about already, the acute psychiatric treatment beds that are not hospital-based, to do some expansion there, a sort of community treatment teams, expanding crisis respite beds for peer support, even continuing to strengthen our peer support. I mean, having peers assist people in ERs is a wonderful idea. We'd have to bridge that world with the hospitals and so forth. But we're talking many millions of dollars just to fully implement that plan. And while we have made continued steps towards that, I think it is a difficult circumstance. And I think that one of the questions also is that sometimes people's response is, well, can you show that if we invest X amount of money here, it will absolutely correlate to you will prevent these circumstances in the future?
Right. And that's what people want.
And you can't do that. And I understand that. There's also this element of there is shared risk when we went to community mental health. And people
from state institutionalization to the community
correct.
Mental health system.
And we as a society need to understand that and what that means. And working and continuing to support families and persons with mental illness in their community.
Now, it's interesting. Claire talked about, you know, training people. I think you called it peer support, Nancy, to sit with someone through those long ER waits to give the mom or dad, you know, a little bit of a break. It reminds me of the CASA volunteers who help children going through the court system.
To a certain degree, although CASA's primary focus is in the courts,
yeah.
advocating for children in the courts. But it's really the peer recovery models that have come out of substance use as well as mental health. But there are a number of curriculums on that, and many of them started and promulgated by persons who have mental illness themselves, people like Pat Deegan and Mary Ellen Copeland and others that have really sophisticated the peer support programs.
And again, a lot of the attention is focused on government funding, government services, community mental health services, and so forth. But to you, Dr. Murray, Claire talked about parity, and, you know, private insurance doesn't treat mental health the same way it treats, you know, broken legs.
No, it absolutely does not.
And is the Affordable Care Act going to change that?
It will change it in law. And what I have seen, I have been in practice in over enough time that I have seen things before managed care and after managed care. And you can legislate parity, but insurance companies have a profit motive. Most of them at this point, very few of them are not-for-profit organizations. They're almost all profit-making organizations. They have a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders, and they will find devious ways to disallow care. The question is, are we going to tolerate it as a people, as a professional group, as people who pay very good, very hard-earned money taken out of our paychecks for this inadequate insurance as far as mental health care goes? If everyone stood up and said, that's unacceptable, you can't take money out of my pay and give me nothing or little back for it for mental illness. This is intolerable. This cannot be. It would change.
Is it going to change under the Affordable Care Act?
I think it's going to take more of a public outcry for it to change. I also think our legislators, basically, I'm a strong believer in representative government. They represent us. And if we send them to Concord or we send them to Washington with a mandate that under no circumstances will you ever raise my taxes, no matter what can they really do?
And again, we were hoping to have some lawmakers join us
right.
today, but weren't able to bring those voices to the table. And I guess to finish up with you, Ken Norton, so what would you say to the family of someone who they fear may be having severe mental health problems? We started off talking about Newtown and other mass shootings. A family member who fears that a loved one may be a threat to themselves or the wider community. What would you say to that family?
Well, the first thing I would say is that you're not alone. And go to the NAMI website, NAMINH.org or NAMI National website, and educate yourself as much as you can about some of these illnesses. Go to support groups, talk to other families, and by all means, don't wait. Listen to your instinct. And if you feel that your family member or loved one isn't doing well, talk to them, talk to other people, and try to get help. And also, I think it's very important for people to tell their stories, letters to the editor, calling legislators. You know, we saw an issue like HIV that was so highly stigmatized and has, because people told their stories, we're really able to change the whole dynamic around it. And we need that to occur with mental illness as well.
Yeah, there were some powerful stories told by parents at your news conference earlier this week. Parents kind of coming out of the shadows and saying, look, this happened to me and I'm scared. Thank you all very much for coming in. Dr. Murray, it was good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Dr. Robert Murray, psychiatrist, vice president, medical director of Riverbend Community Mental Health in Concord. Nancy Rollins, good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Nancy Rollins, associate commissioner at New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. And Ken Norton, thank you for your time.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Ken Norton, executive director for the New Hampshire chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll dig into the conversation about violent media, especially video games, and the huge debate over whether they're connected to violence in society. Then on Friday, we'll tackle the gun issue. We're trying to cover some of the big bases here on The Exchange this week, so be sure to join us over the next few days. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.